Maybe right.
I may be crazy.
Oh, but it just made me a lunatic. And welcome to the Morning Edge. I'm Floyd J. Winters, and here is Augie.
Good morning, Tampa Bay. Well, we were going to do an interview with Johannes Werner. We're hoping that still comes through. We seem to have had a snafu. He's a normally very dependable interview, and He does Cuba Standard Online, and we'll get to that in particular detail down the road here a little bit. The publication, it was a full page article, almost a full page article on the Herald Tribune the other day on the Sarasota section, and it's a coming thing. But rather than get into it too much, and we'll save it for the day that we can have a full interview, and maybe later today later in the show he will call. Cuban dissidents are buoyed by the new era. Now the embassy from the United States, the flag flying, the American flag flying over Cuba. All these are hopeful signs. But in the meantime, Cuba always segues into the issue of immigration. The Cubans escape Cuba, they come here, they become citizens. The people leave Puerto Rico, they are citizens, and they become citizens in the United States. They are swinging the vote in the general elections, and of course the word is that the Republicans under Trump and or anyone else for that matter are going to swing the election to the Democrats because of their immigration stance. And you got some facts about this issue, Floyd.
Donald Trump has been able to make a big issue about the Mexican rapists coming over the borders and how they're bad for our economy and stuff like that. But some of the facts are that immigration, illegal immigration, has actually dwindled, started to fall in recent years as a consequence of our Great Recession. And that has put a downfall in the number of people coming over our border illegally. There's also have a big buildup as far as there are now something like 21,000 Border Patrol agents. That's an army of Border Patrol agents. 700 miles of various kinds of different fences and walls and barriers already. High electronic surveillance and drones circling the area. It's not nearly as bad as it was at one time. And it's going down.
The numbers are going down, right? The thing that I've heard is that Mexico is doing rather well, and people can make a good living there, and in fact, a better living there, instead of coming here.
And it's not the Mexicans right now. It's the people from other South American countries that are trying to escape not just the poverty, but the crime associated with some of the drug trafficking and gangs that are down.
Well, they are also doing sex trafficking, and the cartels are into all of that. The drug trafficking has been the lead point, but there is this other element, and families are trying to save their children from all this. But go ahead, I'm sorry, Floyd.
No, that's a definite fact, and what do you do? And as I mentioned before, if you really were interested in stopping illegal immigration, you would have e-verification from employers. Right now, there is a lot of people on the right who complain about illegal immigrations. And at the same token, their businesses are, through a proxy, hiring illegal immigrants. They'll hire a contractor who will hire subcontractors who will hire the illegal immigrants. So they're not doing the hiring, their subcontractor is. But if you really wanted to cut down on illegal immigration, one of the ways to do that is simply verify, is your employee or are people that your company is hiring, are those employees legal or not? But the fact is, many of these wealthy companies, they make their wealth off illegal immigrants who are working for low wages, and they don't want to stop it. They just want to mouth the idea, oh, we're opposed to this, but yet they'll hire them as their home gardeners, their home nannies, their home housekeepers, their employees to run their businesses, the people to pick the tomatoes that they may have, and yet they'll complain about it politically in the open air and hire them behind the scenes.
Well, you've got the situation with the, I almost want to say the Republican clowns. You almost have a, but on, whatever it's good or bad, Donald Trump has really kind of made them look ridiculous. He stands on stage and says, I've donated. These guys needed my money. I gave it to them. I've given it to Democrats. I've given it to Republicans. And they want money. I don't ask for anybody for money. In fact, I turned down $5 million the other day. He seems to give the independence of the position, even though to the very conservative evangelicals and so forth, he's leading in a whole variety of polls. I was watching Morning Joe this morning, and these issues appeal to this Tea Party group as a core group.
And even the evangelicals. Why is it that the religious group, at least a segment of it, is being attracted to Donald Trump? That's kind of an interesting idea. What is it that he is doing to appeal to many of the religious leaders, the religious conservatives in America? He doesn't seem to offer the compassion of the teachings of Jesus Christ. He seems to be something very different than that, not welcoming people. So how is it that people of this faith are being attracted to Donald Trump? He doesn't say, doesn't invoke Jesus. He doesn't seem to at all have any expression of Christianity.
Well, he went to Alabama, and they had a half-filled stadium there, they said up to 30,000, but many people say it was around 20. But that's
still tens of thousands of people,
right,
that he attracted.
But he said to them, "My favorite book is the Bible." So he's pandering wherever he goes. He's telling people what he knows they want to hear. And his independent approach and his off-the-cuff, seemingly non-scripted situation, you know, he seems to know what he wants, and he says it, and he's not contradicted very well. You know, the Scott Walker gets up there, and he's asked about birthright, and, well, I don't want to talk about that now. I've been on one side, I've been on the other side, but I won't talk about that now. And you've got that kind of prevailing, where do I put my feet here? We're all walking on eggs, all the Republican followers of the Donald Duck quack are such that it's a peculiar experience for people to watch this. And I think in about another week or so, they're going to be on CNN debating again. It'll be quite interesting, Floyd. I want to say one thing, though. 941-745-1490. If you want to get in on the conversation or have a different view or a different subject, please come on ahead. We'll try to have a conversation with you, and we'll go from there. But go ahead, Floyd.
He's also appealing to college-age kids, educated people. He's got a broad appeal. It's broad, and yet at the same token, very focused. I mean, he doesn't seem to have the appeal of a lot of our country, because a lot of people are afraid of the remarks coming out of his mouth. But even women are attracted to Mr. Trump. I think one of the reasons is the total failure of our political system. Our primary systems produce the most far-right and far-left radicals that you
gotta get rid of those.
And as a consequence, yeah, if you can get a person who's not affiliated with these radical, well, he's radical as well.
The parties.
But the parties are so polarizing. And Trump is as well. But at least he offers his alternative view and doesn't seem to be part of the political ugly process that we have right now. And that's the one thing that may be paused about his candidacy, is the fact that we're seeing this rejection of the standard political process that we have. Mm-hmm. And that's why people are attracted to him. Now, they're not looking at the fact he's had four bankruptcies. And here you want
He will tell you on those bankruptcies. Well, most of those were in Atlantic City, and I just got out early, so I didn't get hurt. And so, you know, you're not quite sure what that means. So we have a caller.
Welcome
maybe
to the Morning Edge. Caller, I'm going to put you live on the air.
Hi, this is Johannes.
Hi, Johannes.
Johannes.
Oh,
wonderful.
Welcome. We were hoping to have you in here.
Okay.
I'm sorry.
That's all right. That's all right.
Johannes, before we start, can you give us a brief introduction of your background and what we're going to talk about today so our audience knows that we have a wonderful speaker on the air?
Johannes, there is a big article about you covering Cuba from Sarasota. You've got a picture of Johannes in the front of it, and back to his right is a poster from Cuba. Lots of things are happening. There's an article in the New York Times about Cuban dissidents are really happy with the embassy opening and all of that. So where do we go from here, Johannes?
Well, thanks for having me first. Where do we go from here? There's a lot of attention for Cuba right now in the United States, and most Americans believe that it's already like a normal relation, but it isn't. We need to have patience for an extended process of normalization that's going on, and it's a process that could be reversed after the next presidential election.
There is, what was it, Ted Cruz, one of the candidates, actually is vowing to get rid of any kind of inroads that Obama makes with Cuba already?
There are actually two Republican candidates who have made statements in this regard. One is Marco Rubio, the other one is Jeb Bush. So if Congress does not act in terms of easing the embargo laws, this is a process that could well be reversed. That's a possibility.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that said, the two governments in place right now are very determined to move this process of normalization forward. And we've seen, it was of course big in the news, the first part of this program, which is full diplomatic relations and the opening of embassies. That was a very important step. And now the next steps are following. We have two items on the agenda that are coming up this fall. One is to talk about claims. The United States has about $1.5 billion worth of certified claims against the Cuban government on the book. This is about properties that were confiscated after the revolution, including interest. These are amounts of somewhere between $7 and $8 billion we're talking about.
Oh, you mean that's for property that Cubans living in the United States want to recover, and the United States government wants to recover for them?
No.
Oh, okay.
These are properties that used to be owned by U.S. individuals or U.S. corporations that were nationalized after the revolution.
I thought that's what I said, but maybe I didn't.
Yeah. There are some Cuban nationals in that group, but the reason they were able to register their claim is they're also U.S. citizens.
Oh.
So that's one side. The other side of the story is the Cubans are saying, hey, this is not just about confiscated properties. This is also about the damage you guys inflicted on us via the embargo and sanctions. And they have kept track of all the costs that the embargo has cost, and they came up with about $1.5 trillion. So that's one of those obstacles that we have to overcome in the process of normalization. Another item that's on the agenda is an aviation agreement. At this point, there's no aviation agreement between the two countries, and this in turn does not allow regular scheduled flights by regular airlines to fly back and forth. What we have right now is charter service, which is essentially a more improvised kind of service. But the two countries have expressed optimism that before the end of the year, we might be able to get an aviation agreement, which would allow the majors like American Airlines, Delta, etc., and Cubana, the Cuban air carrier, to fly back and forth between the two countries.
Well, the interesting thing is the more in place the business factors that are issuing interest come into place, the more difficult it will be to change anything. Caterpillar, a very powerful international company is very interested in doing things. I saw that in the article about Cuba Standard that you have so wonderfully presented yourself in the Herald Tribune, Sarasota Herald Tribune.
And we are speaking to Johannes Werner, the editor of the Cuban Standard. It's cubastandard.com, cubastandard.com. He's an expert on Cuban affairs and Cuban business affairs. And Augie?
Yeah, he is. And we've had Johannes on before with, I'm trying to think, Mr. Basquet up here in the Manatee Port, Port Manatee, and what's going to happen with Port Manatee relative to Cuba, and what's going to happen to Tampa itself with Port Manatee. So these business issues should strongly push the Republicans to come in and support what the issues really are in terms of business between the United States and Cuba. Is there enough time to get things into place to make it difficult for that to be pushed away or shut out?
Well, yes, you're correct in stating that U.S. businesses are, well, to make an understatement here, excited about doing business with Cuba, in Cuba. It is indeed a very promising economic perspective for Florida. Overall, this would lift our boats. It would help the Florida economy. That said, I mean, I've been in this scene for too many years to be too optimistic about the power of business. And that is because Cuba is a relatively small market. It's 11 million people. It's nearby. But they have together a GDP that's lower than that of Miami in comparison. So it is fairly small. In other words, if there is a political trend that would make it costly or that would exert pressure on businesses, they will put their resources in lobbying in other places. So it could be reverted. I mean, we do have Fortune 500 companies. You mentioned Caterpillar. There's the big hotel companies that have clearly expressed their interest. There's Carnival Corporation, the cruise giant that is planning for cruises to Cuba now. So we do have big players that are getting into the act, and that translates into more political weight in Washington in terms of the Cuba issue. But again, I'm not totally convinced that this is a process that could not be converted.
I mean, reversed?
Interesting. Cuba has a population of 11 million.
Right.
Florida has a population of 19 million. So even though it's a separate country, it's smaller than Florida. And you say its GDP, its gross national product,
less than Miami.
It's less than Miami.
Yeah.
But isn't that because of their economy just is based upon different factors? It's not so much an economy based upon capitalism as the way we have. Can you kind of add to that a little bit?
Yes, you're correct. There are two issues that have held back the Cuban economy. One is, well, actually I would say three issues. One is history. I mean, this is an economy that was based on natural resource extraction and cheap exports to the colonial powers. First Spain and then the United States. So Cuba does not have a history of industrialization. The second factor holding back Cuba, as you mentioned it, this is a planned economy. There was no private sector to speak of until recently, and there was just very little dynamism in that economy. And the third factor that's been holding it back is the U.S. embargo, U.S. sanctions. I mean, I always use the image of, imagine what would happen to the Canadian economy if they were not allowed to trade with the United States.
Oh, it would be dead.
And you get the picture.
Yeah,
so
exactly.
The reason the Cuban GDP is so low is a combination of all these three factors. That said, I think there's reason for optimism in terms of fairly fast growth of the Cuban economy.
Mm-hmm.
One is tourism. the Cuban government and the Cuban economy have grown tourism tremendously, and it's set to double now that U.S. visitors are streaming to the country. And then the Cuban economy has also focused on areas that are non-traditional activities. We're talking, for instance, about a budding biotech sector, pharmaceuticals that are very promising. And
doesn't that go along with their medical? I mean,
exactly. Mm-hmm. Yes, there's a medical focus in Cuba that's very strong, and that also relates to the growth of services. And the service industry has become a very important factor in Cuba. This is a knowledge-based society, so services look very, very promising for economic growth in the future. We're talking about education, educational services. We're talking about medical services, and Cuba is located smack in the middle of the Caribbean. All the trade routes are crossing there. It's got a history of trade, so trade services are really also very promising.
If the incoming president, whoever that might be, were to considering restoring the previous status, what would the message be to the rest of the Caribbean and the South American countries, Central American countries?
The rest of the Caribbean is scrambling right now because much of the business they have received from the United States, for instance in tourism, is now moving more towards Cuba. So, for instance, Puerto Rico feels the challenge. In the middle of their economic crisis, they see their tourism being challenged because more U.S. visitors are going to Havana instead of San Juan. So the Caribbean is slightly concerned about how this is going to affect them, but overall the mood is very positive towards normalization because the Caribbean nations have always told the United States, normalize, end this embargo, this is not a good situation. And you know, you will see more interaction, economic interaction between the Caribbean nations and Cuba as a result. You will see more trade between Jamaica and Cuba. You'll see more trade between the Dominican Republic and Cuba. So it'll benefit them.
Cuba has been known for being a great help in the countries in distress, and Haiti is one, and Africa is another. Many of the African countries benefited from, in their dire moments, from Cubans coming in and helping. Same thing in South America. But Haiti is in such a mess right now with all of the foundations and so forth, Red Cross failing them.
After the earthquake.
How many years ago was the earthquake? 5, 6 years?
2010.
5 years ago. So you have this circumstance of a people totally impoverished. You fly over that whole island, and the Dominican Republic is, everything is green at the border, because one of the stories has been that the Haitians, historically, all they lived off of, the main export was charcoal. They burned down everything and produced charcoal, and I guess there's still some of that, but the people still living in the shadows of the damage from the earthquake. Where does Cuba come into that alignment? And Puerto Rico having such an economic dire set of circumstances, so that 4,000 of these people almost every month, or a large number, are coming to the United States, fleeing the lack of jobs and the economy generally.
Haiti is in bad shape. It's an economy that has barely grown after the earthquake, and the relief efforts dissipated. But within that, I would argue that the Cuban aid and the Venezuelan aid have been very effective in comparison to all the other NGOs that were there. What the Cubans did is much more long-term. It's not about Of course, they provided disaster relief. They sent medics there to treat people after the earthquake. But their project is to build up the Haitian healthcare system, rebuild it, or I think building it up is the better term. They started with providing free scholarships for Haitians to study medicine in Cuba. So in the past 10 years, they have graduated several thousand Haitians who are now working as doctors in their country. The Cubans are now in the process of building a healthcare system from scratch. It starts with neighborhood doctors' practices and clinics, and it ends with specialty hospitals in the bigger cities. And they're doing this in cooperation with Brazil, Venezuela, and Norway. This is a very unusual combination. Mostly Venezuela, Norway, and Brazil are funding this, and the Cubans are providing the know-how. The Cubans can do that because they've developed a branch of medicine, I would call it crisis medicine. Cuban doctors, Cuban-trained doctors, have learned how to provide a lot with very few resources in very difficult circumstances.
Do they compare with
of disaster or circumstances of poverty?
Do they compare with Doctors Without Borders more so or less so?
Yes, but much more systematic. Doctors Without Borders is not as long-term, and they're more aiming at relief than at building healthcare systems in the countries they are deployed in. The Cubans are providing relief, and they're trying to build up systems. And they do that by involving locals. That's their strength. They're training locals to be doctors and nurses and technicians, and they're involving local people to a high degree. This is really a very strong aspect of the Cuban program.
Well, the two things. One, Haiti's history of leadership within the country has been compromised by the United States under the Clinton administration previously, and that Aristide was taken out of operation there. He was someone who could have pulled the country together and gone through some of this stuff, but because he was such a personality, he was seen as, I don't know, a threat to our interests or what. But and the other thing is we've got the threat to our system, which was really a screwed up system, that the Cuban doctors could become a factor in that whole area and make what we have in terms of providers look like a bit of a joke in this country. How do you see that, Johannes?
I don't think the Obama administration sees Cuban doctors as a threat anymore. The Bush administration did. We actually passed a regulation that tries to lure Cuban doctors serving in third countries to the United States by granting them immigration privileges others don't have. That is still on the books, but you know, the Cuban doctors and their system has worldwide recognition. I mean, they're backed by friends of the United States. The Canadians have expressed their admiration and support for what the Cubans are doing. The Norwegians are funding these efforts. So I don't think we have a situation where our government perceives the deployment of these Cuban doctors as a threat.
They do seem to prevent them from directly. You said they're granting them visas to come into the United States and become doctors. I thought they were having.
Yes, there's, for instance, a group of Cuban doctors that fled from Venezuela. They are in Colombia right now, and they're staging a little picket in front of the U.S. Embassy in Colombia, demanding to be let into the United States based on that regulation.
Oh, wow. Well, your history, your personal history, I knew something about, but only in a small way. The article about you and your having gone to school in East Berlin and crossing the border and living under that regime of the two
I have to correct that.
Oh, okay, good.
The article made me look a little bit like a victim of Stalinism.
Okay, all right.
It's not entirely correct. I was born and grew up in West Germany, and I studied in West Berlin. So I was a Westerner, and I was visiting East Germany.
So you were traveling that way.
Yeah, yes.
You did make it look as though you were under the gun at the wall when you went through and so forth.
No, I was just a regular visitor, and I felt the regular harassment by border guards, immigration officers, and people like that.
So you must have some thoughts about, we were discussing immigration in this country, with the idea of magnifying this 1,900-mile wall. It's not 1,900 miles, but whatever the total distance is, it's in that vicinity, on our southern border between Mexico, basically, and the United States. Walls being what they are, walls, in my opinion, demonstrating the weakness of a country in terms of its democracy when you put them up.
Well, there's something bigger than a wall in Europe, for instance. It's called the Mediterranean Sea.
Mm-hmm.
This is almost like an insurmountable wall. I mean, when you talk about obstacles,
sure,
that's probably the biggest you can get, and it didn't cost European taxpayers a cent. But you have thousands of migrants, desperate enough, jumping into rickety boats, 200 of them in an inflatable raft to try to cross over. I mean, we're talking about distances of 200, 300 miles. We're talking about high seas. Refugees, in particular in times like these of high conflict, are desperate enough to risk anything. So when you build walls, you may deter quite a few of them. I would always argue you're causing death and havoc, because they will keep coming anyways. There's always a group big enough and desperate enough to cross over and to make an impact. And along the way, many will die.
Well, you have the there's a number of ironies going on. I mean, here you have the Europeans accepting these people across their borders. You have on the English Channel, or the Channel, as it were, between France and England, people fleeing through the tunnel or the Channel to go 30 miles across the Channel under the earth and to escape into Great Britain from France, which is odd to me that they would want to leave France, but I guess they like the chillier, wetter weather of England. But and then you have the people coming on shore into Italy, the Italians being hit pretty hard. But now the Macedonians are getting hit, and the Greeks especially, they're landing there, a very impoverished, debt-ridden country in the terms of Greece. But Italy is not far behind in that regard. But they're taking these people in humanitarian way. The contrast to the United States, even though the Statue of Liberty welcomes people of this in this condition,
I would not. Being European, I'm a little more critical of my fellow countrymen and my neighbors. They have no other choice. It is a wave of people. There's no way of deterring them unless you open fire. You know,
mm-hmm.
There's no.
You mean
way
open
of
fire
stopping.
And shoot at them.
Yes, there's no way of stopping these flows of people. There is a lot of resentment in many European nations. There is backlash. So far, the governments of the larger nations have behaved relatively decently in trying to at least coping with the immediate humanitarian crisis there.
Mm-hmm.
The United States, in comparison, is dealing with less of an onslaught.
Mm-hmm.
But, I mean, what we tend to forget, while there's no open war south of our border, there's a hidden war. Particularly in Central American countries, the situation is terrible. If you go to places like Honduras, El Salvador, Guatemala, violence is rampant, and particularly young people fall victim to that kind of violence. And that's what our minor, unaccompanied minor crisis was about. It is still ongoing. What I must say is our justice system has been able to accommodate and alleviate some of this crisis by allowing, granting residency to some of the minors who are coming here. It remains to be seen whether the Europeans are able to accommodate this humanitarian crisis in an equal manner.
Well,
but going back to the United States, yes, there's a huge challenge in terms of the reality and how to deal with the reality. The reality being one of millions of people coming to this country, millions of people living in this country. These are human beings, these are families, they are children. How do we deal with this in pragmatic terms? That's the challenge.
Mm-hmm. Well, Europe, Germany is right now at 90 million or thereabouts, and has experiencing a die-off, and is supposed to fall to about 70. And the Turks in particular have located themselves pretty readily in Germany. France is, I think, somewhat stable in its overall population, but they've got about a 6 to 9% Muslim population, even though Turks are sometimes Muslims as well. But that's where they are, and of course they sit right on the Mediterranean, and boats and so forth can come in there. Italy is a die-off situation as well, going from 60 to 40 million, or maybe 40 to 20 by 2020, a very large reduction in population. So these people coming in are not quite what the Western Europeans had in mind to increase population. England as well.
That's right. And in these terms, the Europeans are less pragmatic than we Americans are. It's the demographic decline is not as drastic, but I agree. This is a situation which immigration is actually a positive economic and demographic factor for most European nations. But they're having an extremely hard time accommodating different languages, different religions, different cultures. A harder time than we have here in the United States. I mean, there are large media, Univision, Telemundo, Spanish speaking. Something like that has not occurred in Europe. The general atmosphere is much less welcoming than it is here. And I would argue this is one of the biggest challenges for Europe. They need to come up with solutions.
When I traveled there many different times, the subject of people coming in, the biggest fear among Europeans generally was Muslims. They definitely were. That was a put-off of an extreme sort. That was something that was a no-no. They didn't want them in, and they feared that they would outpopulate and outvote them and all of the consequent things. The French are experiencing some of that in their northern suburbs in Paris. But it's when you're not reproducing yourself as a population strongly enough, you have to think of ways to change the game and to keep it somewhat the same. You're going to get overwhelmed by outsiders changing your culture, or you're going to maintain your culture through birth. And one of the latest things that the Germans are doing, there was an interview on NPR about students in Dusseldorf, Germany. American students receiving full free education and a job promise at the end in Germany, and they said there were 4,000 students in Dusseldorf University and about 200,000 throughout Germany. Is that, you know about that, Johannes?
Well, I don't think
I heard you chuckling.
There's an alternative to migration from Africa and from the Middle East. I mean, these are the biggest areas of the biggest areas where migrants originate from on the way to Europe.
Mm-hmm.
And those happen to be Muslim areas.
Mm-hmm.
I don't think that any politician in any European country can seriously think about any alternatives and redirecting migration. I don't think that is going to happen. What I do see is a somewhat more pragmatic approach as to who are we going to accept. For instance, the wave from Syria right now is marked by middle class people, professionals, and there are politicians in European countries who would like to accommodate that. You know, if you have a nurse or an X-ray technician or an aviation technician mechanic coming, why not accommodating these kinds of people and granting them a residency in your country if your economy is in dire need of such people?
Well, we seem to fight that in this country, and you're in a curious position. Your business magazine, Cuba Standard Online, is looking at the entire this entire hemisphere, especially.
No, it isn't.
You're not.
It is focused on the Cuban economy and business in Cuba.
Oh, I'm sorry, I misunderstood.
I'm just answering to your question.
Okay, that's all right. That's all right.
Cuba Standard is focused on
Cuba.
On the Cuban economy and business.
That's all right. I stand corrected. So the influence of Cuba is for 11 million people or greater?
Well, what observers tend to say is Cuba is punching above its weight. And there are several reasons for that. One is the focus on certain issues by the Cuban government. They have a strong focus on education and on health care. So that makes them strong. Another thing is because this is such a centralized economy, it's all state-run, when the Cuban state decides we're going to put serious resources in, say, biotechnology, you will see an effect in the long term. Because it's so centralized and serious resources are flowing. And so when Fidel Castro took the decision in the late 1980s that biotech is the future, they never stopped putting resources into that, and now you're seeing the outcome. You have a first generation of cancer vaccines that are coming out. You have a pharmaceutical industry that provides essentially everything, all the basics needed in Cuba, and they're beginning to export that stuff now.
Mm-hmm. So Cuba is focused on by the region, but they are going to be either exemplars or facilitators or share in some kind of benefit or non-benefit to the Caribbean generally. Where do you see that?
Well, we mentioned Haiti, mm-hmm. the disaster relief and the long-term efforts in building health care. The Cubans do have similar projects on a lower scale in places like Jamaica, the smaller island nations in the Caribbean. There's a lot of interaction between Cuba and the CARICOM countries. So Cuba is seen as a leader in that region because of the support it provides.
The cruises, of course, will be augmented, and you will go from Miami to Cuba and then to Cancun instead of bypassing Cuba, or you'll go from Miami to Cuba and then to Mexico or wherever. Is there any other besides the cruises and the medical and the business interest through tourism? Basically, Cuba right now, other than the medical, is a orange and sugar producer, right?
There's not much else at this point, you're right. Cuba traditionally has been a sugar exporter. Tobacco is famous, the cigars and rum. These have been the traditional strengths, the export goods that Cuba provides.
Mm-hmm.
They have created a special development zone around a new deep water port that was built with Brazilian funds just west of Havana. This is almost like the Chinese free zones that were created in the 1980s and 90s. The ambition there is to produce goods and services and sell them not only in Cuba but re-exporting them. So the Cubans are trying to get into manufacturing, into assembly and manufacturing.
Now, the other area that I didn't mention in Cuba, the Dominican Republic, those areas have all produced basketball players and baseball players, and there's always the thought in people's mind when you bring up Cuba, will they ever have a baseball team? Will they have a professional basketball team? They already have soccer big time. So where does that what happens to all of that?
Sports are a big concern for Cubans. So in the course of the reforms, baseball always came up.
Mm-hmm.
And the reason baseball came up is Cubans want to be their baseball teams, their national team particularly, to be winners. And they were very concerned about the drain of the best talents, baseball talents, to the major leagues in the United States. There is a situation in which the reality is that the biggest Cuban talents, most of them end up playing professionally in the United States. The Cuban government 2 years ago for the first time recognized that fact and began to allow Cuban players to play professionally abroad, including the United States. You have now some of the biggest Cuban talents playing professionally in Japan, in Canada, but the Major League Baseball still forces Cuban players to defect. In other words, if you're a Cuban player, it's not like, you know, you can tell your manager, I'm interested in playing for a Major League Baseball team. Major League Baseball tells you, if you're a Cuban player, we won't accept you unless you defect. In other words, if you don't return to your country and if you never play again for the Cuban national team.
Now, when you have this situation and the horizon says it's logical for Cuba to have its own baseball team and become part of one of the two American national leagues, I'm sure that's being considered.
Oh, you are offending 11 million Cubans here.
Oh, is that right?
Cuba has a very strong national league. It's high quality, you know, the big battles between the...
Well, how's that offensive?
Havana, yeah. and the other teams is always a great battle. You have huge stadiums. You have 60,000, 70,000 fans going haywire over their city and provincial teams. So there is a strong league there.
So it could be a third Caribbean league.
There is a history of Major League Baseball teams running farm teams in Cuba.
Oh, really?
Within the Cuban league. This was before the revolution. And then you have to separate that from the national team. In the United States, there is no conscience about baseball being played on a national level, you know. National team against national team.
The American all-stars playing against the Cuban all-stars?
Exactly. Yes.
Uh-huh,
there's a tournament called the Baseball World Classic.
Uh-huh.
And for the Cubans, for the Dominicans, for the Panamanians, for the Mexicans, for the Japanese, for the Taiwanese, for the Chinese, this is a huge deal. You know, it happens every 4 years, I believe. And, you know, who comes out as the winner of this tournament is a huge deal. The United States team hasn't won it so far because it's such a big deal for the other nations, including the Cubans. And to the Cubans, it was a huge impact to be eliminated by the Dutch team in the last tournament.
Ooh.
In the quarterfinals. This was a humiliation. And so all the aiming of Cuban fans is, how can we get back and have a really good national team? And I think the consensus is, let our players play professionally in the best leagues in the world and hone their skills and have them play for the national team in between, you know.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. If
you're from the Dominican Republic, you can play on an American League or National League team without a problem. But if you come from Cuba, you're saying that the baseball commission is requiring you to renounce your citizenship, and it's only directed at one country, that policy?
Exactly. Yeah, there's a weird rule that forces you to come in through a third country, which has brought about all a new industry of human trafficking, specializing on Cuban players. I would argue what's behind this is money.
Sure.
MLB, Major League Baseball, has an agreement with the professional league in Japan. Under this agreement, I would argue that the Japanese league is probably the strongest next to the United States. Under this agreement, if you're a professional player for a team in, say, Yokohama, and an MLB team wants to contract you, the MLB and that team pays the Nippon Professional League millions of dollars in transfer fees for that player. And we could have a similar arrangement with Cuba. MLB has arrangements like that with teams in Mexico. It has an arrangement like that with teams in Europe. But if you're from Cuba, you're cheap, you know. You come free.
Well, how does, I don't understand, how does the Major League Baseball make money off of the deal by requiring a Cuban baseball player to renounce their citizenship?
Because they are saving the $20 million, the $30 million they would have to pay the Cuban Baseball Federation for that player in transfer fees.
Hmm. Well, that's a sizable savings, and depending on the quality of the player, of course, I have some very dark misgivings about baseball today in this country, and I would think that a better relationship with Cuba in terms of baseball and Mexico City, which is another potential area.
You're listening to 1490 AM.
Hold on.
WWPR, Bradenton, Sarasota, Tampa Bay.
Would benefit baseball in a very serious way, and maybe even revive it. Currently, major league sports, whether they're baseball, basketball, or football, are very, very, very costly. And if people start to become aware of Cuban baseball and become interested in the quality of the play, going to Cuba might be a great adventure for people.
I strongly recommend when you go visit a baseball game. It's great. It's unique. It's very different.
We have been speaking with Johannes Warner of the Cuba Standard, cubastandard.com. I want to thank you very much for your participation in this show. Once again, a very, very enlightening program. And we're going to have to cut off right now as our time is ended.
Unfortunately, Johannes, yeah, we're going to have to cut you off and cut ourselves off, and we'll get together again, I'm sure. And I thank you so much.
Thanks, Augie, for having me.
All right.